The Horse Race is brought to you by Benchmark Strategies. Benchmark is setting a new standard as Boston's fastest growing public affairs consulting firm. To know more, connect with Benchmark on Twitter at Benchmark Boston.
This week on The Horse Race, Elizabeth Warren makes it official. She's running for a third term in the U.S. Senate. We'll look at what that means for the state's very restless bench of ambitious Democrats. Then, Governor Maura Healey makes her case for her housing secretariat on Beacon Hill. It's Thursday, March 30th.
Welcome back to The Horse Race, your weekly look at politics, policy, and elections here in Massachusetts. I'm Steve Cazella, here this week with my co-host Lisa Kashinsky. Jennifer Smith is off this week. Lisa, unfortunately, we have to begin with some sad news this week. As you covered in Playbook, Boston lost a local legend.
That's right, Steve. Longtime political activist Mel King passed away earlier this week at the age of 94. He was the first Black person to reach a general election for Boston mayor back in 1983. He was also a five-term state representative from the South End and really just a civil rights leader. His endorsements were coveted in elections in the city. He inspired generations of activists far beyond Boston's borders. And tributes have been pouring in from leaders across the Commonwealth.
That's right, Lisa. U.S. Attorney Rachel Rowland said, "This groundbreaking, truth-telling, unapologetic advocate fought tirelessly for his community. His impact is felt all over our great city. So honored to have learned from him. May his legacy live on." Boston Mayor Michelle Wu said, "Mel King taught us how to serve, how to build, and how to love. His impact and legacy stretch across the boundaries of neighborhood, race, class, and status."
And former Boston Mayor and former Labor Secretary Marty Walsh said that he was a trailblazing civil rights icon and a blessing to our city.
And then just one more, our CEO at Mass Inc., who worked with Mel King over the years, said, "Mel did so much good for our city and our state that he has had an impact on your life, whether you know it or not." So lots of very heartfelt and meaningful tributes to Mel King about the impact that he had on Boston and really all across the state. And for those of you who'd like to read more about Mel King and his legacy, of course, there's stuff to be found all over the internet. I'd specifically recommend Michael Jonas's piece in Commonwealth Magazine that looks at his life and legacy in a really poignant way, I think. So Lisa, also in the news this week is, we have to just mention that the MBTA has a new general manager, so tell us about him.
Yes, we're really feeling Jen's absence this week when we have possibly the biggest team news so far of the Healey administration. So the governor has selected Philip Eng. He is the former president of the Long Island Railroad, someone with decades of transit experience and working as an engineer. It's interesting, he actually is coming out of retirement from the Long Island Railroad to take this job, which means that on top of his $470,000 base salary in Massachusetts, he's also still collecting a pension in New York. So it's a lucrative gig, but it's also one that comes with probably a lot of strife and headaches and, you know, immense pressure to start seeing results immediately in terms of turning around a very broken transit system.
Definitely very broken indeed, you know, one where we have exhaustively cataloged, I think, the issues that the MBTA has had. And I just say about the salary that, you know, if he is even modestly successful at the dealing with the task list that the MBTA has, $500,000 will seem like the biggest bargain that we've ever, you know, we've ever gotten on the MBTA. You know, it's something that I certainly wish him the best at, and we'll be keeping a close eye on how things change.
Yeah, and on that salary note too, you know, the governor did this on purpose. She was trying to make a competitive salary that would attract someone who could actually handle this system, to, you know, attract someone of the right caliber to really drive this turnaround. So now it's up to them.
So, Lisa, we know why Philip Eng is here. He's here to hopefully fix the broken MBTA or perhaps make some progress on it anyway. But the question is, why are we here? What are we doing here today?
We are here to talk about Senator Elizabeth Warren's campaign for a third term, which also means that she's not doing some other things that some of you may have thought she was eyeing. And then we're looking at Governor Maura Healey's push to break out her housing secretariat. Are you ready?
Giddy up.
As you may have seen, well, everywhere this week, Elizabeth Warren has made it official that she's seeking a third term as a U.S. Senator from Massachusetts. She's been saying this for a while now, nearly 2 years to be exact, but this announcement should officially put an end to speculation that she might be eyeing something else, like maybe another run for president. So this announcement shouldn't have been surprising, but Steve, were you surprised by this announcement, and what should we take away from her decision?
I was not surprised. I mean, this is what the people, I mean, we can say this in retrospect, but this is what the people who knew had been saying and what they've been telling us. You know, there was a lot of, I'm not sure what the right word is, but rampant speculation and, you know, gossip and rumors and people trying to push stories that, you know, Lisa, I'm sure you heard a lot of the same ones, but that she wasn't going to run again, that she was actually going to step down in the middle of her term, that Governor Maura Healey was going to appoint specific people to replace her. Just wild stories, wild speculation. And, you know, her announcement this week just kind of put a stop to all of that.
Yeah, and that polling tracks with what we, you know, just know of the Democratic primary electorate's leanings in Massachusetts. And, you know, you have a more progressive leaning primary electorate that aligns with Elizabeth Warren more so on policy. And then you look at, you know, the rest of the state, which does tend to lean, you know, a little bit more moderate when you open it up to the broader segment that includes independents and everyone else. So this lines up perfectly with what that what your polling shows.
And there have been rumors about potential Republican opponents. Lisa, do we know anything about those names yet?
No names yet, but the chair of the state GOP, Amy Carnevale, told GBH's Adam Riley that at least two Republicans are considering a run. What will be interesting, though, to see is, you know, whether Republicans can kind of unite around one candidate to take on Elizabeth Warren and kind of get that general election on their side started a bit early, or if they're going to be divided like they were in the gubernatorial primary, where you saw kind of the more conservative part of the party put forward one candidate, the more moderate part of the party put forward a different candidate. Those divisions still exist within the party, even with the new chair. So it'll be very interesting to see going forward if they can kind of put aside those differences to rally behind the candidate, one candidate to take on Elizabeth Warren, or if we're in for kind of a slog fest of a primary on the Republican side. And another thing to note here is that, you know, the two potentially strongest contenders that the Republicans would have, former Governor Charlie Baker and former Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito, they're both in the private sector right now cashing in. So it's unlikely that either of them would make a run. So that, you know, kind of knocks two of the biggest players, biggest names, and biggest fundraisers on the Republican side off the board right off the bat.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly the historical precedent worth mentioning, which is Scott Brown and Martha Coakley. You know, Scott Brown certainly wasn't somebody that everybody was thinking of as far as who could come out of nowhere and beat Martha Coakley. But the situation certainly is different now. You know, the Senate is very closely divided. The impact of sending one person of either party to the Senate versus someone of the other party is potentially huge. It could potentially decide the Senate. It could be the one vote that gives unified government to one party or the other. So, you know, it's very different than it was then, also very different than electing a Republican governor, where the Democrats have super majorities in both houses, and the Republican governor, the governors that we've had have been somewhat limited in terms of what they could actually do. So I think sometimes you hear, oh, if Charlie Baker would only run for Senate, you know, then the Republicans would have a better chance. But there's a lot between, you know, a theoretical moderate or even a real actual moderate that everybody likes and being elected to Senate over Elizabeth Warren.
Republicans are also going to start at a serious cash disadvantage against Elizabeth Warren. She has about $5.4 million, or had, I should say, at the end of 2022 in her Warren Democrats campaign account, which has kind of been her catch-all through her various runs over the years. you know, that's a lot of money to start off with, you know, especially with, again, you know, kind of calling back to some of the more prolific fundraisers on the Republican side likely to not make a move in this race. She's been sending out a bunch of fundraising emails, you know, in the past few days since her launch. We'll see in a few weeks when the next batch of FEC reports are due, how much she was able to rake in off that launch.
Well, it certainly does extend the timeline for others who might be looking to replace either her or Senator Markey. Definitely something we'll be keeping an eye on as, I guess, the years go by.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll have plenty of opportunities to talk about this coming up. And you know what? 2026 will be here sooner than you think.
It's no mystery that the state of housing in Massachusetts is not very strong. To start with the obvious, there's just not enough of it. A serious unit shortage crosses the state. Cities and towns often resist building multifamily homes, even near transit. And despite money in the budget for affordable housing subsidies, wait time for the available units can stretch out years. Part of Governor Maura Healey's proposal would involve reorganizing who's in charge. What will that do? Well, here to talk with us about that is Sam Drysdale of the State House News Service. Welcome, Sam.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so start us off with the basics. Who runs housing policy right now, and how would the proposal that's on the table now change that?
Sure, yeah. So right now there is an existing Department of Housing and Community Development, and what the governor is proposing, and something that she ran on, this was an early campaign promise of hers, is elevating that and expanding the abilities that that department has to an executive office, and turning the director of DHCD into a new housing secretary that would have kind of broader responsibilities and capabilities.
So this isn't a new concept. In over various administrations, economic development and housing secretaries have been combined. They've been split up. It hasn't been at this level. So what's the sense of why the governor is trying to do this now?
Yeah, I think there's a sense of urgency right now around housing in the state. Most recent numbers, and some people say this is a conservative estimate, is that there's 18,000 people living in homelessness in Massachusetts, and there's generally an affordability crisis in the state. The governor often points to people leaving the state to move to more affordable states like New Hampshire, just across the border. So I think she feels that housing is among her number one priorities, and this is a way to signal to people that it's going to get the resources and time that she feels that it deserves.
And other than that sort of more abstract sending a message or a signal, what would this actually do in terms of the powers that a new secretary would have that aren't being exercised right now?
Yeah. So this is from her filing letter when she filed this bill with the legislature. She says that the new executive office would be responsible for expending funds, marshaling resources, advancing innovative solutions to provide safe, accessible, affordable, and environmentally sustainable housing, and supporting the growth of vibrant and livable communities throughout the Commonwealth. So I think part of what the secretariat would do also is try to attract more funds from DC. That's been something that the governor is talking a lot about with all of her secretariats. But there's so much money out there right now for states from DC. So trying to make sure that Massachusetts gets its share of those funds for things like affordable housing projects.
And do we have a sense, whether from the filing letter or testimony that she or Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll have given so far, kind of what the mechanics of the split are? What stays under the economic development umbrella, what goes to the housing secretariat?
Yeah, so the right now housing and economic development secretary, Yvonne Howe, who will just become the economic development secretary when and if this split happens, she testified that if this split happened, it would allow her to focus more on economic development initiatives instead of having her office kind of split between this dual purpose. So she was, again, talking about trying to get funds from DC, specifically ARPA funds and things like CHIPS funding, which would go towards science and technology initiatives and bringing jobs into the state. So I think she sees that her role would be able to kind of shift to be focused more on bringing jobs into the state and affordability, while the housing secretary role would solely be focused on housing.
And of course, there was a legislative hearing about all of this just this week. What happened at that hearing? How did lawmakers seem to be reacting to this proposal?
Yeah, so lawmakers were pretty universally in support of this proposal. The hearing was before the State Administration and Regulatory Oversight Committee. All of the lawmakers present said that they were really supportive. There was also a good number of just regular residents of Massachusetts and housing and homelessness advocates who were there saying that they supported the idea. So it seems like she might have an easy time getting it passed.
And the lawmakers that were there kind of gave her a crash course in the different housing issues affecting their communities in kind of their very light line of questioning, we'll say. They definitely took it easy on her with that because they do seem to be generally supportive. So can you give us kind of just a brief overview of what the different issues are that they've identified that they kind of signaled they want the Healey administration to focus on?
So there's obviously the conversation about affordable housing and the amount of affordable units in the state. And those are, you know, legally defined affordable housing. But then there's also generally the non-legally defined affordable housing, which is just housing that is affordable for residents without having to apply for a voucher or that sort of thing. There were a few people who came forward and talked about their difficulties with the voucher system, saying that they've had to deal with long wait lines and how difficult the process is to get a voucher to be placed in an affordable unit. Senator Mark Pacheco of Taunton, he brought up that the new secretariat could be helpful in putting in place new regulations for cooperative home ownership for those living in manufactured housing communities. Those are like 55 and up communities, which he says there's a lot of difficulty with those becoming too expensive to live in. So that's something that the housing secretary could take on, especially as Massachusetts residents are aging and we have an aging population in the state. So that was just, you know, one thing that they brought up. But generally, they were just excited about the idea and pretty supportive.
So there's one interesting character in all of this that I want to touch on and just ask you a bit about, and that's Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll. She seems to be at the front and center of a lot of what the Healey administration is pushing on this. She, of course, famously fought her own Titanic battles on housing when she was governor of Salem. So how does she fit into this? How is she sort of helping the Healey administration to advance their cause here?
Yeah, so the governor, really at the start of her administration, named Driscoll as kind of her point person on housing. She was named to lead the working group that the governor put together to discuss the cabinet level secretary prior to them actually filing the bill to make that secretary position. That group includes lots of different housing advocates from around the state, both public and private developers. And they're really trying to push that this is, you know, kind of a all hands on deck. We need public and private sector to be working on this, geographically diverse, and focusing both on the preservation of housing that's currently available and the production of more housing. Driscoll has really stepped up and kind of taken the lead on that for the administration.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see in hearings now that those are really picking up. Whenever there is a housing question, Healey just takes the mic and moves it over to her lieutenant governor and is really letting her, take the lead on that. And I do just want to ask, so we're used to the legislature really taking their time on things, but the timeline for the housing secretariat is going to be different in its approval process than what we're used to seeing, and I think a lot of people understand. So walk us through what the timeline is.
Yeah, sure. So with reorganization, there was an accelerated timeline, like you said. So the governor filed a bill to create this housing secretariat on March 1st. And under the provisions of Article 87, which is the reorganization article, they have 30 days from when she files that legislation to reorganize to schedule a committee hearing. And then the committee has 10 days to either recommend that they approve or disapprove of the reorganization to the legislature. 60 days from when the governor files the bill, the legislature needs to make a decision. They can vote it up or down, but unlike normal bills, they can't make their own amendments to it. So they really just say, we, you know, approve of this, or we don't think this is a good idea. And if they fail to act within those 60 days, it'll just automatically become law. So based on the current timeline of her filing on March 1st, that could happen on May 1st, which would be 60 days out from when she filed that bill, which is coming up pretty soon.
And then just to end where you began, your piece in State House News starts with a story of Tim Scalona. So tell us about him and why his experience is illustrative of the larger issue here.
Yeah, so this young man testified at the committee hearing on Monday, and he is a second-year law student at Suffolk University, and he was able to really show lawmakers a kind of personal experience of you know, who he hopes this housing secretary would affect in Massachusetts. He told his story of becoming homeless when he was in eighth grade in 2012. His whole family became homeless when their house in Wilmington was foreclosed on. And he talked about a decade of going in and out of the shelter system and being uprooted and having to start new at school. And he's talked about his own journey of now being a law student and a homelessness advocate and trying to pull himself out of poverty, even as his family is still dealing with it. And really illustrated to lawmakers how much of a crisis the housing situation in Massachusetts is right now, and was advocating in favor of this. He said he felt that it would create a first step towards addressing the housing problem in Massachusetts.
Well, Sam Drysdale of the State House News Service, thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And that brings us to our final segment, which comes to us from the very rapidly growing Antique Firearm Safety Department here at Horse Race Global Media Empire headquarters. This is the second week in a row where we've had some weird local story about muskets being found in surprising places. Lisa, what do we have this week?
This time it was a TSA agent at Logan found a musket in a passenger's luggage and confiscated it, which makes me wonder if I crossed paths with said musket because I was flying this weekend in and out of Logan.
Admit it, Lisa, it was you. You were carrying your antique musket onto the airplane.
I don't think so. I don't think this was me, and I'm staring at this picture of just how long this musket is with this person's duffel bag, and like that thing looks taller than me, so it definitely was not. I'm too small to carry that through an airport. But Steve, have you ever had anything confiscated by TSA?
I have never once in my whole life tried to carry an antique musket onto the plane. I have many questions about how this thing could have been potentially fit into an overhead compartment, even if they had gotten it through the check. The only thing, the spot that is still sore in my heart from the TSA is that they confiscated my grandmother's homemade raspberry jam that she was trying to bring us, and I don't know what happened to it, but I hope somebody enjoyed it.
That is sad. Like, you
Very
shouldn't
sad.
I don't know.
I don't like talking about it.
We'll move on. Luckily, I guess for you, that is all the time we have today. So no more talk of lost treasured family recipes at the airport. I am Lisa Kaczynski signing off with Steve Cazella. Jennifer Smith will be back next week. Our producer is Adam Boyaji. Please don't forget to give The Horse Race a review wherever you're hearing us now. Subscribe to my Massachusetts Politico playbook, to Commonwealth Magazine's Daily Download, and reach out to the Mass Inc. Polling Group for polls. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.